directed against everyone.
So what are the antecedents to Trump in America? You say there are. We have about 30 seconds.
The antecedents to Trump are the KKK, obviously, the 1930s, the America First movement is an antecedent to Trump. He references it. And throughout, Nixon is an antecedent to Trump. He ran a harsh law and order campaign in 1968. He slashed social spending to increase crime. So Nixon is a good.
We're going to continue the conversation after the broadcast, and we'll post it under web exclusives at democracynow.org. Jason Stanley, philosophy professor at Yale University. His book is How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. I'll be speaking tonight in Washington, D.C., interviewing Angela Davis at Busboys and Poets at the 450K location in Washington, D.C. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Carla Wills. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5 o'clock, and the KBOO Evening News is next.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted.
This is Cat Meow.
And this is Becky.
And we want to hang out with you.
The Development Committee will meet the third Wednesday of every month at 7 p.m.
We're traffic informed and
food motivated.
And we're seeking like-minded individuals who want to use their rad fundraising skills and talents to
support the station. Join us.
Join us.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Save the Village, an open house for community in action on Sunday, October 14th from 2 to 5 p.m. at Foster Village in Portland. Save the Village is an open house of Foster Village which features tours, information of the skills and best practices of community living, live music, food, and celebration. There will also be the opportunity to learn more about the expansion of Foster Village through the purchase of the Orange House. Again, that's Save the Village, an open house for community in action on Sunday, October 14th from 2 to 5 p.m. at Foster Village, 4635 Southeast 64th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, investigators identify a body found on Mount Hood as that of a missing Arizona hiker.
Hurricane Michael roars ashore, bringing massive devastation and deaths.
And a runner from the University of Oregon who has cerebral palsy is the newest Nike ambassador.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 11th, 2018. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Annette Newell. A woman is suing the city of Portland for mental and physical injuries she says she suffered as a result of actions by Portland police officers 2 years ago. Julie Cross was at City Hall on October 12, 2016, to testify about the upcoming vote on the police union collective bargaining agreement. The hearing was canceled a half hour after it began, and police began moving attendees toward what Cross's complaint declares an, quote, a narrow doorway that opened directly into a staircase, unquote. Cross was caught in the mass of people and claims she was shoved by three Portland police officers, Heidi Kreiss, Jasmine Sutton, and a third unidentified officer. She says she suffered whiplash and post-traumatic stress disorder in the aftermath of the incident. Cross is asking for almost $1 million in damages from the city under the Oregon Tort Claims Act. The complaint alleges that the shoving constitutes excessive force and that the actions of the officers were not subject to privileges under the Oregon law governing the defense of the premises because people were invited to speak at an open and public forum, and Cross was complying with the evacuation orders at the time she says the officers assaulted her.
Investigators have identified the body of a Phoenix, Arizona man missing since Monday. A climber on Mount Hood found the body of a 30-year-old David Yagmorian at about the 8,300 elevation mark on Mount Hood today. Yagmorian's body was sent to the Clackamas County Medical Examiner to determine the ID. Early findings are that his body showed signs of hypothermia and injury from a fall, estimated at 30 feet. It also appears he had been trying to set up a tent, had a sleeping bag and other equipment with him. Yagmorian was an Arizona State University research assistant. Yagmorian had been hiking on Mount Hood when he disappeared earlier this week. His body was found far higher than searchers expected him to be.
Both of Oregon's U.S. senators are joining in a call for a crackdown on big tobacco social media. Jeff Merkley and Ron Wyden are on a list of 15 Democratic senators signing a letter asking the Federal Trade Commission to investigate how tobacco companies are marketing to young people. The letter says that the tobacco company's use of social media is the latest chapter in their, quote, long history of using misleading marketing tactics to addict young people to their deadly products, end of quote. The senators say that current law already restricts tobacco ads from TV and radio and requires warning messages.
The grandson of Mahatma Gandhi arrived for a visit to Portland today. Dr. Arun Gandhi joined members of local churches and Portland's mayor to talk to the media about his visit, which will include speeches at the Muslim Educational Trust and a Baptist church in northeast Portland.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here. I look forward to coming to Portland every time because not only I have wonderful friends here, but I have a long association with this city. It goes back to the early 1990s when I spent a summer here teaching at Portland State University, a course in nonviolence. So it goes back a long ways, and I enjoy coming here every time. I'm here again to plant some seeds of nonviolence. You know, we have built a whole culture of violence around us because of the lifestyle that we have chosen all over the world, which is based on materialism and money. And it's made us very selfish and self-centered. And so to protect the things that we have, we need to have security. And security leads to a whole culture of violence, a culture that has seeped so deeply in us that everything about us is violent now. Our sports is violent, our religion has become violent, our relationships are violent, everything is violent. And in the midst of this culture of violence, we are trying to seek for peace. And it becomes very difficult to achieve that. But we have to get out of that culture of violence to be able to enjoy real peace. And it's not something that cannot be attained. It's a very simple thing. We just have to learn to allow compassion, understanding, respect, and love to dominate our thinking and our relationships and our attitudes so that we can relate to each other better. But in the culture of violence, we allow all the negative emotions and attitudes to dominate us. And so we are always suspicious and we hate people and we are, we exclude people because we treat people as guilty until they are proven innocent. And that is wrong. I think we need to reverse everything, and that is the message that I take everywhere in the world, and that's the message I've come here to share with people in this city. So I once again thank everybody who has invited me here, and would be glad to answer any questions if you have any. Well, I think everywhere I go, I see a lot of strife in every country. And it's very sad. I was just in Beirut, and of course that's right in the midst of a hotbed there. But every country has a lot of strife, and because of the inability of people to get together and live together and understand each other. Well, I must say the biggest takeaway is the enthusiasm of the people, and especially the young people who are looking for an alternative, looking for a way to achieve peace and harmony in society. And when I take the message there, I mean, they're really touched by it, and I find a lot of them coming over and over again to learn about this message. So there is some hope. Oh, all the memories that I have are favorites. I spent 2 years with him, and during those 2 years he taught me some very important lessons, and I think the most important one that I would like to share with everybody is learning how to understand and deal with our anger. You know, we have been taught to abuse anger, we ignore it, we don't want to talk about it, we don't teach it. And yet anger, grandfather told me, is wonderful. It's a very powerful and a very useful emotion, but only if we use it intelligently. But it can be just as deadly and destructive if we abuse it. So he taught me how to use anger intelligently for the good of humanity rather than abusing it. And I wrote a book on it, and the book came out last year, and it's already translated into 30 languages. And yesterday, while I was waiting at the airport in Chicago for my flight here, I got a message from my agent that a Hollywood company has bought the rights for a feature film and a TV series.
That was Dr. Arun Gandhi speaking in front of City Hall today.
A group of Democratic senators are calling on U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to change a new State Department policy stopping diplomatic visas for unmarried same-sex partners of foreign diplomats and employees to the U.S. or at American-based international organizations. The senators, including Oregon's Ron Wyden and Jeff Merkley, say the new rule discriminates against diplomats from countries where same-sex marriage is still illegal. They say it could stop foreign diplomats from bringing their families to the U.S. and threaten progress that's been made on this issue.
U.S. Senator for Oregon Ron Wyden has, for the first time, praised a Trump administration appointee. Wyden, a Democrat, has been critical of most of the Republican administration's appointees, from Scott Pruitt as head of the EPA to Pruitt's replacement, Andrew Wheeler, both of whom are skeptical of the international scientific consensus on climate change. This time, however, a former wildland firefighter has been assigned to the head of the U.S. Forest Service, a move which Wyden says is good news for Oregon. Vicki Christensen, who has been running the agency since early March when Tony Took resigned amid a sexual misconduct investigation, yesterday's announcement made her appointment permanent. The Forest Service oversees 14 million acres of forest land in Oregon. It's also one of four agencies that oversee official wilderness areas in the United States. The main issue mentioned in Wyden's endorsement of Christensen is the unprecedented scale and duration of wildfires, especially prevention and suppression measures that require state and federal coordination. It remains to be seen how Christensen's tenure will affect Oregon's forests, as both fire prevention and suppression involved one of Oregon's enduring political hot potatoes, how much logging to allow, and who gets to do it.
Justin Gallegos, a runner at the University of Oregon, has won a sponsorship from Nike to help him complete his goal of finishing a half marathon in under 2 hours. Now, what makes this special? Gallegos has cerebral palsy and runs for OU's running club. He's been running for 7 years and is Nike's very first professional athlete with cerebral palsy. Nike surprised the runner with a 3-year contract at the end of his most recent race, which fell on National Cerebral Palsy Awareness Day. Gallegos wrote on his Instagram page that it was the most emotional moment in his 7 years of running.
Measure 102 could ease the burden of affordable housing here in Oregon by allowing bonds to be used for privately built units. KBOO reporter Aiden Moyer and the Oregon News Service have more.
A measure on Oregon's ballot this year aims to remove restrictions in the state's constitution and open up more affordable housing. Referred to voters by state legislatures, Measure 102 would amend the state constitution so that bond funds raised by local governments could be used on private projects to build affordable housing. The measure gained bipartisan support in the legislature and has the backing of both gubernatorial candidates. Statewide, Oregon faces a severe shortage of affordable housing units. John Bartholomew with AARP Oregon says the state needs to use every approach available to tackle this problem because it's older Oregonians who suffer most.
Older Oregonians are often on a fixed income. Unfortunately, many, many Oregonians are living off of Social Security alone. And when their rent increases, they can't just go out and get a raise or find another job that pays better.
Bartholomew says the measure would open up more options and lead to more creative solutions to the state's housing crisis. Opponents say there aren't enough safeguards in the measure to ensure it isn't abused by public officials. Bartholomew says the Portland metro area isn't the only place facing a housing crunch. A Realtor.com report from 2017 found that housing shortages in Eugene was second only to Seattle. In light of this crisis, Bartholomew says Oregon should use every tool at its disposal.
Measure 102 is not the silver bullet to solve Oregon's housing crisis. However, it is one tool that should be effective in helping mediate the problems that we're seeing right now.
Passage of Measure 102 could affect a metro housing bond in Portland. According to the campaign, Yes for Affordable Housing, bond measure 26-199 is estimated to fund homes for 7,500 people and would increase to 12,000 people if the constitutional amendment passes. State officials will begin mailing out ballots for the November 6th election next week. In conjunction with the Oregon News Service and KBOO Evening News, I'm Aiden Moyer.
First reports indicate that at least 6 people were killed by falling trees and debris as Category 4 Hurricane Michael barreled ashore yesterday in North Florida. Florida Governor Rick Scott said the initial recovery effort was massive as crews attempted to clear roads blocked by fallen trees and debris. Power lines were down across roads and yards as 97% of people in Tallahassee faced days or even weeks without electricity. Interstate bridges were impassable. Some coastal communities near Panama City appeared from the air to be largely obliterated by the 155-mile-per-hour winds and massive storm surge. Patients were being evacuated from the city's Bay Medical Sacred Heart Hospital and from Gulf Coast Regional Medical Center. Officials in Panama City wrote on Twitter, "The damage to our infrastructure is the most widespread and severe we've ever experienced. Thousands of trees gave way to the tropical storm force winds." After initially maintaining hurricane strength while barreling inland through Georgia, Michael had weakened to tropical storm status by Thursday morning, moving northeast over North and South Carolina and Virginia. Though maximum winds dropped to 50 miles per hour today, heavy rains threatened to worsen flooding conditions in an area already devastated by last month's Hurricane Florence. The cyclone is likely to continue across land and re-enter water in the Atlantic Ocean tonight or tomorrow.
National Native News covers Native American and First Nation news, issues, and culture. On today's episode, a British Columbia First Nation is suing a grounded tug for a fuel spill in the Inside Passage, a memorial walk for Native American children who passed away in a Grand Rapids boarding school, and a Kansas Republican official has resigned after describing Cherise Davis, a Native American woman, running for the 3rd Congressional District in a very unkind way. Here's more.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A British Columbia First Nation is suing the operator of a fuel barge which spilled diesel near its reserve. Jacob Resnick has more.
Heltsuk First Nations member Kelly Brown got close enough in his boat to make out the name of a grounded tug.
Nathan E. Stewart sunk, and there's fuel just flowing out of the boat.
He shared video of the encounter in the Inside Passage that was reposted by the Vancouver Sun. Fortunately, the tug's accompanying fuel barge had delivered its load in Ketchikan and was nearly empty. Still, around 26,000 gallons of diesel and other oils from the southbound tug Nathan E. Stewart spilled that morning. An investigation later found a crew member had fallen asleep during watch. Nearly 2 years later to the day, the Heltsuk Tribal Council filed a lawsuit against the BC and Canadian governments. The suit also names crew members and their employer, Houston-based Kirby Corporation, which regularly ships fuel from Washington State to ports in Alaska. The Heltsuk First Nation's hereditary chief, Frank Brown, addressed reporters in Vancouver.
Our law has been violated, and the legal action we are taking in the BC Supreme Court today is our attempt, our bid, to hold industry and government accountable for this negligence.
The Kirby Corporation released a short statement saying its lawyers were reviewing the claim the company would defend its interests in court. BC's Environment Ministry said it's committed to engaging with the First Nation tribe as appropriate for a federally led initiative seeking ocean protection. Citing the lawsuit, neither would comment further. The October 13, 2016 spill ignited concerns about Canada's spill response capabilities in the Inside Passage. It reportedly took the first Canadian Coast Guard vessel 20 hours to reach the spill site from its port in Prince Rupert. The Heltsuk First Nations has been pushing for spill response capabilities of its own. Those efforts were redoubled last November when an Alaska-bound fuel barge ran into trouble near Bella Bella, BC. The northbound Jake Shearer broke free from the fuel barge it was towing. This time it was fully loaded with about 3.7 million gallons of various petroleum fuels, but its crew was able to drop anchors before it hit the rocks. Marilyn Slett is the elected chief counselor of the tribe. She said Alaska-bound fuel barges remain a worry around her hometown, Bella Bella.
And our community has definitely raised a lot of concern around the articulated barges, and, you know, certainly we're living through the experience with the Nathan E. Stewart and the near miss with the Jake Shearers.
The Canadian government has proposed exclusionary zones for oil tankers in the Inside Passage, but the Alaska-bound fuel barges are below the tonnage threshold and would be exempt from the rule. I'm Jacob Resnick.
A memorial walk this week in South Dakota acknowledged 45 children who passed away in the Rapid City Indian Boarding School. A crowd of more than 200 people took part in the event, which included the reading of names. Organizer Heather Dawn Thompson.
Charles Long Turkey, 15 years old, Lower Brule. Dorothy Cryer, 12 years old, Pine Ridge. Evelyn Day, 15 years old, Crow Creek. Female child, number one, year 1919, tribe unknown.
Thompson says there are likely more than 100 others who passed away due to disease, malnutrition, or froze to death while trying to escape. Volunteers are continuing to look for further information. The Kansas City Star reports a Republican official has resigned after comments about Democratic Native American congressional candidate Cherise Davis. A social media message by Michael Clanny to a women's Democratic group went public this week, which said in part, "Your radical socialist kickboxing lesbian Indian will be sent backpacking to the reservation." Davis is openly gay and has competed as an amateur and professional fighter. She's running for the hotly contested 3rd Congressional District seat. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The Public News Service is a member-supported organization that aims to cover issues that affect us all, but might not be reported by the mainstream media. On today's roundup, Hurricane Michael crosses into Georgia. The Trump administration is considering punishments for permanent residents that use benefits, among other moves that are aimed at limiting immigrant and refugee rights. The AARP is hitting the streets to educate people about the upcoming elections, issues affecting those who are fresh out of prisons, and an update on NAFTA.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for Thursday, October the 11th, 2018. I'm Mike Clifford. Hurricane Michael expected to reach Virginia by this evening. Also on the Thursday rundown, the comment period opened now on Trump's plan to limit green cards to immigrants who use benefits. Plus, some are calling the NAFTA replacement a missed opportunity for both dairy and the climate. First, here's our top story. Hurricane Michael crossed into Georgia Wednesday evening. That after a devastating landfall near Panama City, Florida, earlier in the day. The Richmond Times-Dispatch reports Michael will quickly travel northeast over the Carolinas on Thursday and Thursday night before clearing offshore on Friday morning. That means several hours of heavy rain for the Richmond area in Virginia between Thursday evening and Friday morning. People can now officially weigh in on a proposal by the Trump administration to punish legal permanent residents who have used certain public benefits by making it harder for them to get a green card or a visa.
The proposal comes despite studies that show legal permanent residents use benefits like the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program or Medicaid at similar rates to U.S. citizens. The rule change appeared in the Federal Register on Wednesday, which kicks off a 60-day public comment period on the website regulations.gov. Ben Monteroso with the group Mi Familia Vota sees the move as cruel.
It's trying to continue the narrative that President Trump did, that immigrants are bad people and freeloaders, lazy people, and criminals is another attack of the Latino community.
He points out that undocumented migrants aren't eligible for most kinds of public assistance. The Department of Homeland Security says people who receive these types of aid should be declared a public charge, which would count against them if they apply for a green card or visa. I'm Suzanne Potter.
The move is part of a series of federal actions targeting the immigrant communities, some of which are tied up in litigation, including termination of DACA and the TPS program aimed at stepping up immigration raids, separating parents and children at the border, and moves to end the policy that allows migrants to sponsor family members to come to the U.S. Voting in Iowa next month will include a soft rollout of the state's new ID law. Ross Brown reports nonpartisan groups still say voting is easy and they want to see a large turnout for the midterms.
AARP State Director Brad Anderson says his group is working alongside Iowa's Latino Political Network and state auditors who want to educate voters about this year's changes. According to Anderson, they want to make sure voters who are most affected by issues such as Social Security, Medicare, prescription drug costs, and their own financial security have easy access.
Iowa does have some new voting laws, and we are targeting Iowa's 50-plus community as well as Latino voters because historically they are among the most impacted by new election laws, and the 50-plus community in particular has been historically the largest voting bloc in the state of Iowa.
Iowa's voter ID law officially takes effect for the 2019 elections.
The Latino Political Network, along with AARP, will host awareness and education events in five cities next week, including Bettendorf, Cedar Rapids, Des Moines, Mason City, and Shenandoah. And in her continuing series on crime and addiction, Mary Sherman reports today on community impact.
Criminologist Donald Hutcherson of Cleveland State University and Policy Matters Ohio Director Amy Hunauer reviewed more than 40 studies and found that serving time behind bars makes it more difficult to obtain an education, find a job, and fulfill parental obligations. It's not surprising to Maggie Cook of East Liverpool, who has witnessed the cycle of addiction, prison, and poverty within her own family.
They will do the time, and we don't have the rehabilitation in the prison, so they're not getting any better. They get out, and they try to get help, and it's still pointless because they still have that felony. You see it every day. People can't get jobs. They can't get their kids back.
Louis Tobin with the Ohio Prosecuting Attorneys Association counters that the criminal justice system already works to provide treatment options to keep people out of prison.
When you talk to judges and prosecutors, you'll find out that, for the most part, we're already offering treatment to addicts in the community. And by the time a decision is made to send somebody to prison, they've violated community control or probation 6, 7, or 8 times. And if you don't get them out of community, something worse is going to happen.
The review predicts Issue 1 would allow 10,000 people to be treated in the community instead of prison. This story was produced in association with Media in the Public Interest and funded in part by the George Gunn Foundation.
And finally, Eric Tegedoff reports a Minnesota-based think tank says the United States' new trade deal to replace NAFTA is a missed opportunity, especially for small-scale dairy farmers and for action on climate change.
President Donald Trump says the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, or USMCA, is a win for dairy farmers because it opens up part of Canada's market to exports. But Karen Hansen-Kuhn with the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy is skeptical it will make a big difference for the industry, which is facing a crisis of overproduction and low prices. She says the Canadian market as a whole is small, about the size of Wisconsin's output.
And we're not talking about opening up the entire market. What they achieved under USMCA is opening up about 3.6% of that market to U.S. exports. So honestly, the impact on U.S. agriculture, U.S. dairy farmers will be minimal.
Hansen-Kuhn says this deal will hurt dairy farmers in Canada, which has a supply management program designed to support small family farmers.
The USMCA is awaiting approval from Congress. I'm Mike Clifford, and you have been newsin' and cruisin' with Public News Service. We are member and listener supported, and we're online at publicnewsservice.org.
To the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the lingering impact of hurricanes like Florence and Michael. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio, and then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather, clear skies in the Portland area, no chance of rain, down to a low of 46 degrees. The weekend ahead looks sunny and on the warm side, with highs at around 70 and lows in the high 40s. The sunny stretch should last all the way through until next Friday, pardon me. Today in history, on October 11, 1991, attorney Anita Hill accused then-Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas of sexually harassing her. She testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Thomas denounced the proceedings as a, quote, high-tech lynching, and was confirmed to the Supreme Court, where he still serves. The quote of the day is from Anita Hill, who said, "I did what my conscience told me to do, and you can't fail if you do that."
And now it's time for Labor History in 2 from host Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1874. That was the day that Mary Heaton Vorse was born in New York City. Mary grew up in Amherst, Massachusetts, in a family with significant financial means. She traveled across Europe with her parents, where she received her education and learned to speak multiple languages fluently. She then worked as a book reviewer for the Criterion magazine. In 1912, Mary and the man who would be her husband witnessed what would be known as the Bread and Roses textile strike in Lawrence, Massachusetts. The experience was a great turning point in her life. She later wrote, "Both Joe O'Brien and I had come a long road to get to Lawrence. Together, we experienced the realization of the human cost of our industrial life. Something transforming happened to both of us. We knew now where we belonged. On the side of the workers and not with the comfortable people among whom we were born. Some synthesis had taken place between my life and that of the workers. Some peculiar change that would never again permit me to look with indifference on the fact that riches for the few were made by misery of the many. It was in Lawrence that we realized what we must do, that we could make one contribution, that of writing the workers' story as long as we lived." For more than 50 years after Lawrence, Mary traveled the United States reporting and participating in strikes and the labor movement. She wrote about the 1919 steel strike and the lumber workers' strike in the Pacific Northwest. She wrote about the struggles of auto workers and textile workers and child labor. In 1962, the United Auto Workers honored Mary with their Social Justice Award. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Current Cast is dedicated to one of our most precious resources, our fresh water. On today's episode, invasive mussels in the Great Lakes.
Invasive mussels muscle their way into the Great Lakes on this Current Cast.
You might think a creature the size of a dime is no match for a freshwater system the size of Texas. But quagga mussels are prolific breeders. Multiply one by trillions, and you get mussels that can wallop even a big body of water. Native to Eastern Europe, quaggas, like their cousins the zebra mussels, barged in through the ballast water discharged from ships and were first spotted in Lake Erie in the late 80s. Quagga mussels feed year-round on plankton and other organisms, depleting food supplies for native fish, which can create a devastating domino effect in the food web. So finding a way to knock out these invaders is critical to preserving a healthy Great Lakes ecosystem. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Climate Connections aims to show how climate change is already affecting our lives and what we can do about it. In today's episode, we go to Puerto Rico, where activists are growing an Earthship.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In Aguada, Puerto Rico, volunteers pack recycled tires with earth. Then builders carefully stack the tires into dome-shaped huts. The result is the island's first Earthship. When complete next year, it will consist of five structures, built around a central garden and connected by a rain catchment system. Despite the name, the Earthship is not intended to move. Quite the opposite.
Each tire is like a 300-pound brick, so it's definitely not going anywhere with the wind.
That's Laralina Melendez of the nonprofit Colectivo Verdolaga. She's long been fascinated by Earthships, which have been built around the world since the 70s. But after Hurricane Maria, she knew she had to bring them to her native Puerto Rico. She says Earthships are ideal relief shelters because they're strong and self-sufficient, with solar power and sewage treatment on site. So this first project in Puerto Rico is intended to show what's possible. Melendez hopes it is the first of many Earthships across the island.
If we go through another Maria, but we have Earthships to rely on for water, for safety, and for community more than anything, that'll change things so much.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
The National Board of the Pacifica Radio Network has passed a resolution in support of the whistleblowing online publisher WikiLeaks and its founder, Julian Assange. Assange has now spent 6 years inside the London Embassy of Ecuador, which granted him asylum in August of 2012. Alex Steinberg, a delegate to the National Board from WBAI New York City, read and motivated the resolution.
Be it resolved that the Pacifica National Board calls for the freedom of Julian Assange and an end to the harassment, including the halting of internet and media access at Ecuador's London Embassy, the end of efforts to imprison Assange by either the UK government or US government, and the end of attacks on journalists and whistleblowers by the U.S. government and the corporations who control the government. Lastly, be it resolved that the Pacifica National Board will produce a press release that it has passed this resolution, followed by the text of the resolution, and add a hot link to the press release in the notices and news section of its website.
Thank you.
Can I motivate it real quick?
1 minute.
Okay, 1 minute. The Julian Assange case is a key case for freedom of the press. And as you know, he's been hunted by the U.S. government with the cooperation of the government of the U.K. And now it looks like the government of Ecuador is ready to hand him over to the tender mercies of the Justice Department. And his crime is very simple. He exposed the machinations of the U.S. government in various ways through the whistleblowing activities of WikiLeaks. We have to support Julian Assange, and at a time when he has few friends left, mainstream media has basically been silent about the harassment of Julian Assange and the attempt to imprison him, and even some so-called progressive outfits have been silent. I think if the Pacifica makes a statement, it will be a very important issue, and can serve to educate many people in this country and beyond. Thank you.
And the Pacifica National Board passed the resolution with 12 members voting yes, 0 no, 4 abstentions, and 3 not voting. The Pacifica Radio Network includes KPFA Berkeley, KPFK Los Angeles, KPFT Houston, WBAI New York City, WPFW Washington, D.C., and 300 affiliate stations, including KBOO.
Laura Al-Qassem, a Floridian graduate student, is still being detained in an Israeli airport with no sign of being released. This is the longest time that anyone has been detained for having supposedly supported BDS since last year when Israel began enforcing a law banning anyone that has ever supported a boycott of the State of Israel from entering the country. Al-Qassem, the granddaughter of Palestinian immigrants, entered Israel on a student visa. The recent college graduate is pursuing a career in human rights studies. She has not been heard from directly since being detained, but people who have communicated with her say that she is being held in a small room with a bed-bug-infested bed without a phone access and no internet. Her lawyer, Yotam Ben-Hillel, stated that, quote, "We're talking about someone who simply wants to study in Israel, who is not boycotting anything. She's not even part of the student organization anymore," end quote. The Strategic Affairs Minister, Gilad Erdan, stated that, quote, "If Laura Al-Qassem will tomorrow in her own voice, not through all kinds of lawyers or statements that can be misconstrued, say that support for boycott, divest, and sanction is not legitimate and she regrets what she did, we will certainly reconsider our position." BDS is a movement that calls for peaceful action against Israel's occupation of Palestine by boycotting, divesting, and using sanctions.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 11, 2018. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, so we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Aiden Moyer, Grace Ann Smith, Sam Bowman, and Teresa Mitchell. The producer is Grace Ann Smith. And our engineers, we have a triple threat tonight: Sam Bowman, Mike Fataklis, and Layla Kanaan. The interim directors of Evening News and Public Affairs are Sam Bowman and Teresa Mitchell. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting, Ani and Lynn take your calls. At 9, the beloved community welcomes the Imam of the Islamic Center of Portland, the only Shia mosque in the metro area. At 10, Valley Views continues the discussion with activists from the SEIU Oregon Care Works about their work in the long-term care economy. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, The Digital Divide talks to the co-curator of Fireboat Micro Cinema about their ongoing film series. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
For tonight's in-depth segment, KBOO reporter Yasmin Kobanoglu spoke with Vanessa Bolin from Mutual Aid and Disaster Relief in North Carolina about the aftermath of Hurricane Florence.
My name's Vanessa Bolin, and I am a community organizer and indigenous artist and activist, and working with Mutual Aid and Disaster Relief and a couple other organizations here in Lumberton, North Carolina, as of the moment.
And so what is Mutual Aid Disaster Relief doing right now in the Carolinas?
So Mutual Aid and Disaster Relief and Project Hope, which Project Hope are local community leaders who have a nonprofit. Mutual Aid Disaster Relief is a larger entity of a nonprofit. And what we are doing is providing support and food and water and cleaning supplies to to those who are affected in Robeson County, which is the Lumberton and the Lumbee Nation territory. We've been helping since before the flood, and during the flood, we did rescue via boat and just driving into the waters to get people out. And after the flood happened, we started focusing on getting food and water and supplies, cleaning supplies. That's what we're doing right now.
So what have you seen and heard on the ground there?
Well, during the flood, there were a lot of people who did not evacuate. They had areas that had never flooded before that ended up flooding. And we're talking some water levels that were to roofs. And then communities in areas that had never flooded saw water that came into their homes, damaged a lot of roof from the wind. This is the largest county in North Carolina. It's also the poorest county in North Carolina. It's 65% indigenous, people of color, Hispanic, and other. And it is the poorest county. So last 2016, they had a flood here. They had a hurricane that caused some flooding, and people were just starting to recover. They said it was a 500-year flood. It never happened again. This one was bigger. So the way I got involved here, I was working with a group called Eco Robeson on some pipeline issues, because once again, the pipelines have targeted a indigenous community and a marginalized community to build the pipeline. So that's how I got involved in this area, working with people on pipeline issues. And then the flood happened, which is kind of directly related because of climate change and fossil fuel industry. So what has happened here is people paid attention to the hurricane. They watched the flooding happen, and then it was crickets. No media presence, nothing. People's homes are still flooded. There's still standing water underneath people's crawl spaces, in their basements. There's roofs that are just destroyed. Water is still coming in. There's another hurricane on the way. We are going to get some rainfall here that's going to inundate the already saturated ground. People are worried about flooding. And the problem is that supplies into this marginalized, poor community have slowed to a trickle. There are people who still are bringing stuff in. It's just not enough. Also have seen the county did finally declare it, or the state, it was a disaster area. So they put out that people could get emergency food stamps. And why I keep talking about this being the poorest county, most of the people who do have jobs here work in the service industry, be it at a restaurant or at a convenience store or at a dollar store or something like that. Well, when these businesses started opening back up, they told people, you have to get to work. Now, remember, people's homes are flooded. All the shelters started closing. People were going back to moldy homes, trying to get them a safe place to live. But these businesses are saying, come back in or you have to work. The county started doing emergency food stamps, but what they did was gave people 8 days, and they had to come in person to the county office and fill out the paperwork, and then they're making them wait up to 30 days. Now, remember, supplies have slowed to a trickle. Where we had stuff where we could get food and water and cleaning supplies and diapers and formula into people's hands has dried up. The county has now closed the registration. That 8-day period to apply for emergency food stamps has closed. And there are many, many thousands of people in this community who had to go back to work, whose homes are still flooded, whose cars were destroyed, who had no way to get there. And the county has effectively shut them off. So people who were paycheck to paycheck were already out of work for some up to 15 days. Some of them still haven't been able to go back to work. And now the county has cut off the one piece of aid that they were going to get. FEMA is denying claims right and left and telling people, oh, it doesn't matter about the black mold, you can still live there. And people are going, but I can't live in my home. And they're saying, well, appeal. So this marginalized poor community is now literally paycheck to paycheck. People are now going to be months and months and months behind. We're in, do I buy my medicine this week? Do I buy some food to feed my family? Where am I going to live? Landlords are already telling people, hey, you're going to have to get out of here, and by the way, because there's going to be a housing crunch, I'm going to up the rent after I fix it up, and you're not going to be able to live here. There's stories of people sleeping in their cars because their homes are full of muddy, nasty mess and black mold. So this community is suffering, and the news media has effectively shut down the help, and they're just not telling the story. Many people have posted things up on Facebook, and it's the biggest share of anything about the flooding that I've personally done that's gotten any attention. We're doing everything we can, reaching out to every group, begging people, please come help us just tarp roofs. We can't fix them right now because there is no money to do that. The supplies are not there, but at least we can put a tarp up and prevent further damage. And then we have people still rolling up to this warehouse that literally has hardly anything in it, asking for food, asking for water, asking for diapers and baby formula. They're not asking for the world. They're asking for enough to feed their family, to feed their children. They're asking us, can you please come with a tarp and just put a tarp on my roof? Guess what? We don't have tarps. We have little bitty tiny tarps that we can piece together, but after two houses, they're gone. So this community is just suffering, and I'm just trying to get the world to pay attention to what's happened after this flood and the position that these people have been put in.
So you see the lack of supplies and resources as kind of a result of the lack of media coverage?
Oh, it has to be. It has to be. And I know there are good people out there doing good work. I'm working with multiple groups like the Black Flag, like the Mutual Aid, like the Eyes Wide Open Project, a lot of folks from Richmond, people in Appalachian.
And do you think this kind of resistance for coverage and attention could be because the population is underrepresented and underserved in that area?
Absolutely. It's 100% got everything to do with it. If this was a rich neighborhood, oh my goodness, the stories that would be being told, the outpouring, the coverage it would be getting. But this community is so marginalized, 65% of it, they don't care. They don't care. They didn't matter before. Why should they matter now? And now everybody's turned around and looked at Florida and the flood that's coming there and the hurricane, but yet these people are still trying to recover and are going to suffer the effects of the storm as it comes through this area and dumps even more rain on saturated grounds.
So you're speaking about Hurricane Michael. How do you see that affecting the area in the next coming days?
So the trajectory of the hurricane shows it coming straight up, and it's going to come through Lumberton. Now, initially it was a Hurricane 1, and they were expecting it to be 1 to 3 inches of rain in this area. Now that's up to a Hurricane 3. Depending on which way it hits, if it hits a little bit to the west, the rainfall here is going to be a whole lot more than 1 to 3 inches. And in some parts of this county, 1 to 3 inches, and remember all the roofs that are damaged, the water has already destroyed a whole lot. It's going to just cause even bigger mess for those few people who've been able to clean up inside. The roofs are not fixed. So the water that is coming and any flooding that happens below them that maybe rolls down their way through a river or a creek or any levees or anything that gives away, because they're already weakened. There were many. The flood here was not a one-day thing. It literally lasted 5 days. There would be roads that were open, and then hours later they would shut down because a levee would give, a dam would breach, something would happen, and then it would stop, and then further up it would happen. And so for 5 days, they just kept getting inundated with water. So what's already swollen, what's already saturated, is just going to happen again, not to the extent when the hurricane hit in the North Carolina, South Carolina area, but they are still going to get drenched with water, which is going to create a bigger problem for this already struggling community.
And how do you think that people maybe outside the area, like us over here in the Pacific Northwest, can help in the effort to rebuild this community?
The biggest thing that people could do are send food, send medical professionals. I have been out in this community. I've personally tried to help people who have all kind of bacterial infections from being in the water, from coal ash that spilled over, and they've gotten yucky stuff and the pig waste that was in the water. There's horrible funguses. So doctors, nurses, anybody who can come in that could help would be wonderful. Send food, send cleaning supplies, send diapers, get home or Lowe's cards and send them in so that we can get tarps and supplies to try to help people get their homes so that they're livable. Send cash donations to one of the nonprofits we're working with. There's a lot of things. And if you can't afford to do that, because things are happening everywhere, if you can't afford to do that, like put down some tobacco, put up some prayers, think about us, send good vibes, something. But be aware that there's a community of people here, an indigenous community that is really suffering, and they need your support and help. Just be aware of them. Don't forget about them. They're struggling already.
So make sure to keep up the public awareness.
That would be wonderful. I would love to see news media flowing in. Tonight we were in the home. We got contacted, and this is a vast county, and I'm hoping I'm saying this right, but I believe it's correct. The county as a whole, it equals about 938 or 36 square miles. It's a vast county, and a lot of it's very rural. We just went and got a call about an 88-year-old woman who has Alzheimer's, and the whole back of her house, the hurricane caused water just to come in the whole back of her house. And we've got this rain coming in. There's already black mold growing on her ceiling, and we're taking tarps out and going to try to tarp her roof to prevent any further damage and try to get her some support in there. We're going to try to help get it cleaned up and fixed up. But the roof, the whole backside of her house is damaged from this hurricane. And we're just hearing story after story after story. And there's like 8 people here at this warehouse, sometimes 6, sometimes 4, who are trying to push out supplies, get in supplies, get support, go out and fix people's roofs and just do what we can. But today, what broke my heart is this family come in and they said, we need some food. Can you help me? And I started walking around the warehouse and I realized, and it just kind of hit, I have nothing to offer them. I gave them a box of green bananas that somebody had donated, all these bananas, green bananas. I gave them individual servings of one little case of this stuffed pasta stuff, and then some individual packets of chili and some canned water, because that's all I had to offer them. And it just broke my heart. I'm like, how long is this going to last these people? And that's not a very balanced meal. If any of them have diabetes, heart disease, those things are loaded with sodium. The carbs in them are so bad for anybody with diabetes. So we're not able to help people. If somebody came in right now and needed baby formula, I would have to struggle. We've got so few cans left. I don't know what we would even give them. Diapers, I think there's one box of diapers left. If somebody asked me that, just seeing this community, being aware that they're here, being aware of the struggle. And also, I would love to see people reach out to Robeson County, to the city of Lumberton, and say, why have you limited people to 8 days to get emergency food stamps? And why are you telling them it could take up to 30 days? We don't have food to feed them, and you're telling them it's going to take 30 days? How is that supposed to work out? And what about the people who were really, for very good reason, unable to get there? Why have you limited this to 8 days? It shows a lack of concern or care for this community.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me today. Is there anything else that you would like to add at the end here?
No, I thank you for hearing this voice. I don't speak for this community. I'm bringing their story out to the world and trying to get some attention here. I'm just trying to get their story out because it's so sad and it's heartbreaking. And they're lovely people. Like, people are sharing everything they have with their neighbors. They're coming and saying, hey, I know this elderly person needs your help. Can you help me? and they're taking what they need. They're not taking a bunch of stuff. They're taking only what they need. So this is a beautiful community. These are beautiful people, and everybody is just coming together and doing the best they can. We just need more. There's a joke, and I had never heard it until recently. People said, oh, yeah, said Robeson County. That's a resource. Things go out of it, but nothing ever goes back into it. And that's the truth. They just take and take and take from this community, but nothing ever comes back into it. So let's just start putting something back into this community. We have an opportunity to help people who really need it and build them up. And I love mutual aid and disaster relief. This is solidarity, not charity. Let's give these folks some solidarity. Let's help them out and let them see that they're valued in the world. We care about them. We see you. That would be a beautiful thing to happen.
This was KBOO reporter Yasmin Kobanoglu speaking with Vanessa Bolin with Mutual Aid Disaster Relief in North Carolina.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5:59. Coming up next, Rose City Native Radio.
KBOO hosts a monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater called KBOO at the Clinton. This month, on Thursday, October 11th at 7 p.m., we'll celebrate Dia de los Muertos. Muertos Film and Music Night will highlight some of the Dia de los Muertos traditions of Mexico, Central and South America. We'll screen authentic Day of the Dead short films and feature live performances by Virginia Lopez, Mariachi Portland, and more. Again, that's a film celebration of Dia de los Muertos, Thursday, October 11th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.